The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, July 10th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's program, a pair of meetings in the past 24 hours have addressed health and housing. Yesterday, the Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks held a meeting to discuss last month's disclosure a pathologist was impaired while working. And last night, the next step regarding Willow Heights Public Housing was the subject of a session. Reports on both in just a moment. In about an hour on 91.3 on NPR's Here and Now, Flint, Michigan became the synonym for bad water when the citizens were exposed to lead in 2014. Now the author of a new book says there are still lessons that cities can learn about failing infrastructure. That's on Here and Now, beginning at 1 on 91.3, right after this afternoon's Ozarks at Large. Three singer-songwriters will share their songs and their stories at a Songwriters in the Round session at Stage 18 tonight. Jamie Harris, Christina Cavazos, and Meredith Kimbrough will perform tonight from 8 to 10 at the downtown Fayetteville venue. Jamie and Christina are visiting from Austin, and we claim Meredith as a Northwest Arkansas voice. Tickets for tonight's show at Stage 18 are $7. It's about 7.5 minutes after 12. Highs this afternoon should be between 89 and 92. Several hundred veterans, some very sick, showed up for a town hall meeting yesterday morning at the Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks in Fayetteville. They were demanding answers about a VA pathologist recently fired for working while impaired. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, an external review is underway to determine just how many pathology reports are flawed.
The Fayetteville VA hospital was filled to capacity with veterans, some wearing bandages, tethered to oxygen or in wheelchairs, including Harold Lindsay, a Navy veteran who lives in Springdale.
I'm one of the few that got caught, diagnosed wrong. And so I'm trying to find out what in the world's going on and what they're going to do.
Lindsay's one of seven veterans so far misdiagnosed by a Fayetteville VA pathologist found to be working while impaired. The VA is conducting an external review of 33,000 cases for 19,800 veterans, tracing back 12 years. More than 5,000 of those veterans have died. One death has been linked to the pathologist, but no details have been offered. So far, a total of 2,500 cases have been reviewed. U.S. Army Korean veteran Jess Pear of Fort Smith says he was tested several years ago, and all the results were negative, no cancer.
So now, you know, I'm looking at having them redone to make sure that, you know, these growths that I have on my lung and on my liver and all that stuff are really benign and not serious.
Marlene Cahey's husband, a Vietnam Navy veteran, died 3 years ago. She just received notice that his pathology reports are being screened for errors.
I just want to know why.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs announced the news June 18th, sending out letters to all impacted veterans. The pathologist was first discovered to be impaired in March of 2016. He completed treatment and later returned to clinical care, relapsed, and was removed from practice in October of 2017 and subsequently fired last April. The VA will not disclose the identity of the pathologist due to federal health privacy laws, but the Associated Press is reporting the pathologist to be Dr. Robert Morris Levy of Fayetteville. According to public records, Levy is a 1992 graduate of the Pritzker School of Medicine at the University of Chicago. A source formerly associated with the VA told Ozarks at Large that Levy is an alcoholic. Calvin Parks, VA interim medical director, told the audience at the town hall meeting the independent review will take 6 months to complete and case follow-ups will quickly occur. He also apologized multiple times.
As a veteran, as a patient at this hospital, to my fellow veterans, I say I'm sorry that this has happened. To our family members, I say I'm sorry that this has happened.
During the Q&A, one veteran stood up pointing to what he described as a broken chain of command at the Fayetteville VA. Parks responded by saying, hopefully this incident will cause VA hospitals across the country to scrutinize their pathology departments. There were also questions regarding lawsuits against the VA for wrongful practice, which Lisa Bruin with the Little Rock Regional VA Benefit Office addressed.
Some people will want to turn to filing a tort claim and with an attorney, and that's fine too. But I want to let you know that VA is already set up with law to protect veterans in this sort of situation. It's called Title 38 U.S.C. 1151.
Bruin encouraged any veteran identified as having a false negative pathology report, even for non-service-connected diagnoses, to file a report, which could produce monetary awards also available to families and children of deceased veterans. Towards the end of the meeting, Vietnam veteran Harold Logan stood up and told the crowd he's really sick.
Right now, I'm being diagnosed with 3 to 6 months to live.
Logan says he's been diagnosed with 5 different types of cancer. He says he received a letter stating his pathology reports are under review. More than 3,000 veterans have contacted the VA's crisis call center, 1-866-388-5428, since the news broke. The Fayetteville VA, which operates 6 satellite clinics in northwest Arkansas, southwestern Missouri, and northeastern Oklahoma, sees around 53,000 patients annually. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And Jacqueline's report for Ozarks at Large was filed in cooperation with Arkansas Public Media. You can find out more about Arkansas Public Media at their Facebook page. Support for Arkansas Public Media comes from Simmons Bank, with more than 90 community-based locations in Arkansas providing banking and lending services. More information available at simmonsbank.com. Simmons Bank, dreams realized. Every year, the Fayetteville Housing Authority is required to turn in a budget to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that outlines how it plans to spend its HUD money. This last year has been a particularly controversial one for the Housing Authority after it announced plans to sell one of its public housing properties so it could expand on another piece of land. Last night, the Housing Authority Board held a special meeting to vote on the latest 5-year plan. But as Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us, the public who attended is more interested in how the agency plans to address more immediate problems at its current properties.
Candace Sizemore Houston was one of the dozens of people who came to last night's Fayetteville Housing Authority meeting.
About the Willow Heights living conditions is that this is an emergency. We are like a bad situation away from a baby in the hospital. People are leaving those apartments because it's so hot, and we cannot be philosophical much longer.
Sizemore Houston is the owner and director of Teeny Tiny Preschool.
We're located in the Willow Heights subdivision in South Fayetteville.
She says she offers scholarships at cost to make sure some of the children who live at Willow Heights can attend her preschool.
Income diversity is really important, which is something that comes up here a lot. So yes, we want to be an income diverse school. I think it's really important to children's development because we all need to see that we're the same and we're different. At the same time, we need to see that we can have a friend who lives here or we can have a friend who lives there. They have different family lives, they have different home lives. And it, as a society, I think it makes for a more stable society at large.
Sizemore Houston says having her preschool on the property and working with Willow Heights children exposes her to the persistent issues at the public housing complex.
Well, my experience is that the buildings are really, really old. They're incredibly old. The plumbing is ancient, and all of the bathrooms are on the upstairs, so they have a lot of leaking ceilings. And I will say that the Housing Authority addresses these issues. I mean, but it's like watching something like a gun rapid fire or something. I mean, it's they're old buildings.
That is to say, the agency has a very hard time keeping up with general improvements, let alone unexpected issues. Part of that has to do with the budget the Fayetteville Housing Authority gets from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Here's Executive Director Denise Smiley.
So for 2018, HUD has announced our award at about a $281,425. That's what we have for three properties: Hillcrest Towers, Lewis Plaza and Willow Heights. That's the money that HUD has awarded us for capital improvements.
The Housing Authority hasn't seen a sum that large since 2011. It's also about $97,000 more than the agency received last year. But board commissioners say the actual capital they need for improvements easily stretches into the millions. Here's Smiley again.
So what we have done this year, as well as we've done every year, is come up with a plan for how we will use that money.
Smiley says that's a requirement from HUD, which includes not only a plan for the year, but a plan for the next five. Smiley says the Housing Authority has had to use the budget for the current year to make projections for the future, even though the actual amount HUD will give the agency changes every year.
We have a dollar amount, which we have no idea we will even be awarded the amount of money. So we have used the same dollar figure that we've gotten for 2018.
Last night's meeting was contentious at times, as board member Melissa Terry brought up the future of Willow Heights, which may still be sold to a developer and torn down. Those residents would then be moved to new apartments on a property called Morgan Manor. The exchange you're about to hear involves Commissioners Chris White and Melissa Terry.
There's no votes going on right now, to my knowledge. In other words, we've already voted to extend the contract. So we're going to hear from these people, and then what are we going to vote on?
Well, we have in the legal opinion from our Housing Authority attorney says that we have the option to proceed and spend another year on a tax credit application that's pretty much dead in the water.
We don't know that.
That's pretty clear. And or based on the language in his legal opinion that we have the option to back out of the contract and proceed with our own plan as a Housing Authority for that property.
In a 3-2 vote, the board ended the discussion about Willow Heights in favor of moving on to the five-year plan. White told the room any decisions on Willow Heights specifically could be made later, while Terry insisted a vote on how to proceed with Willow Heights was a crucial piece of the agency's plan. Here's Chairman of the Board Mike Emery with his response.
You're ignoring the main thing about the five-year plan is that it's a fluid plan.
But it's a
plan. We can change it. We have to turn it into HUD. Well, that's why we have it, is because HUD requires it to go in. But it's fluid in what we do with it down the line.
When the board turned the conversation over to the audience, many focused on the immediate needs at each property instead of the long-term plans before the board.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Pamela Wiles. I stay in Willow Heights with my son. I asked my mom to come see me this next month. She wouldn't come because of where I told her I live at. My son, Ms. Ken said, he can't have friends over. It got so bad. And I'm working with two air conditioners trying to provide for me and my son to stay cool. One in his room, and I'm sleeping downstairs to stay cool.
And the air conditioning at Willow Heights is a problem. There's no HVAC systems. Denise Smiley says the Housing Authority has considered getting AC window units for everyone at the complex. There's just one problem.
We as a Housing Authority cannot buy those and put them in the units because it would be violating HUD rules.
Smiley says HUD won't allow the window units because they'd be blocking potential emergency exits. Although the agency is looking into mini splits as an alternative option. Terry says the project could be funded through community development block grants awarded to the city. Here's another exchange between Commissioners Terry, White, and Emery.
How many applications have we ever submitted to CDBG for air conditioners?
I'm not going to take
your bank. The answer is zero. So.
Well, that's not my job.
Well, we will. And I'm just going to say this. Those buildings have been there pushing 50 years. This is not the first 110-degree summer.
Right.
So it's not just the members of this board.
That's right.
You know, just saying. There are other members, in the past. So, but things have happened. So we're going to move on.
After the board voted to approve its five-year plan, Terry did suggest forming a task force made up of board commissioners and community members that could work on finding funding to address the immediate needs of Housing Authority residents. Candace Sizemore Houston, who runs Teeny Tiny Preschool, says that's what she wants to see.
I do happen to be of the particular opinion that whatever needs to happen for the people needs to happen first.
In an ideal world, Sizemore Houston says she'd like to see Willow Heights rebuilt. But from a more pragmatic standpoint, she also supports the expansion at Morgan Manor. And for her, it really just comes down to this.
I feel like we're having a lot of philosophical discussions about whether or not this could create a problem. And I'm nervous that some real intense life issues. I don't have a perfect solution, but I'm kind of frustrated with the debate for a perfect solution. I think that people need homes.
The Housing Authority Board plans to hold a vote on establishing a task force at its next meeting, July 26th. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
And if you're interested in more information about the Housing Authority Task Force mentioned in this story, you can contact the Fayetteville Housing Authority offices. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
You can sense the gradual shift into election season. Friday, three groups seeking positions on the November ballot in Arkansas turned in petitions with thousands of signatures to the Attorney General's office. If enough signatures are verified for each, voters could make decisions about casinos, term limits, and the state's minimum wage come fall. While those are still only possibilities, we do know that issue one, setting a cap on damages and attorneys' fees in lawsuits, will be on the ballot. To get an early season breakdown of some of these matters, we turn to John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. Roby says the supporters of the term limits proposal easily exceeded the number of signatures required on their petitions for the verification process.
They turned in a lot of signatures, way more than they need. We've had convictions of elected officials. It's going to be pretty easy pickings for the term limits people to say, don't you want to curtail these people's activity right here? How overwhelmingly do you think term limits would pass if it qualifies, which it looks likely to do?
Fairly overwhelmingly. I forget when we passed the initial term limits, it was up there in the two-thirds, over 60, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I would think so. Again, the surprise is that people in 2014, whether they knew they were doing it or not, extended term limits, essentially, because an ethics amendment was amended by the legislature, by John Woods, now infamous and convicted legislator, to say that it took the number of years you could serve if you got elected and fulfilled, got limited in the House and then got limited in the Senate, and said you could serve all of that any
kind
way
of a
you
cumulative,
wanted.
Yeah.
I just don't think people fully grasped what was happening, and they probably would not have done that had it stood alone. So the national term limits people, this limits it to 10 years. And I think, so I think that passes in any political environment in Arkansas. But right now, the political environment in Arkansas, I believe, and this is the only thing that might give somebody like French Hill trouble against a credible opponent in Clark Tucker. Throw out the people who are in office, and because the succession of legislative corruption stories and convictions has soured people even to an unusual level. They're already soured to politics, but soured them even more. And that is a factor. Were you going to get ready to ask me about issue one?
I am
one?
About to do that.
Okay, you go ahead
but
and
you
ask.
Steal my segue if you
no,
want
no, no,
to.
No,
it's
no,
fine.
No, no,
so,
no, no. You,
so you've been tweeting and writing a lot about issue one. You say it's the most important item on the ballot this next year. It is the one that changes the rules for the judiciary, lets the legislature control this. It puts caps on certain damages. It's the tort reform proposal. How do you see term limits possibly being impacting that vote?
Well, this way. I wrote a column about it.
What? Thursday.
It appeared Thursday. Mm-hmm. And I based it largely on visiting with former Supreme Court Justice Annabelle Tuck, who heads one of the committees that's opposing it, but her focus and the focus of her group is not the limits on what plaintiff's lawyers can make in terms of contingency fees, and not on limits of damages. They're leaving that to other
Both
people
of,
to
are
argue.
Two pretty powerful messages, right, right, though, but, that could duke it
right,
out.
Right, and she gets into those. She can't help it. But mainly her side is saying this section that says the legislature by three-fifths vote shall do the rulemaking of the courts. In addition to being a violation of separation of powers doctrine, it changes this principle. Now, the rules of criminal and civil procedure, how we proceed in our lawsuits, and under the grand rules that are known to everybody, are set by professional committees working for the Supreme Court, made up of lawyers and all forms of legal practice, and are subjected to public hearing and public review, and then the Supreme Court adopts them or doesn't adopt them. This says the state legislature can inject itself into that process and say, no, we're going to vote, we're going to try to vote by 60 out of 100 in the House and 21 out of 35 in the Senate to write the rules ourselves. And if you write the rules, as she says, you're the umpire of the baseball game. And if you're the legislature with fluid power to meet and make rules, then you could set the rules at home plate pregame meeting with the managers, then you could change them in the sixth inning if things weren't going the way you wanted. And she, conceivably, lobbyists for private interests who don't like outcomes at the court could use their influence, which we have seen at the state legislature, to get rules changed. And then you get into, she's wondering, how is this, are we going to have retroactive application? She said, this is a recipe for abuse and disaster. Now, I say all that to say, to your question, I got tons of reaction to this column. And a lot of it was trial lawyers are saying, way to go, and retweeting it. But there were a lot of conservative people saying, I'm conservative, I'm Republican. I don't want these corrupt, you know what, setting the rules of the court. And when you start hearing that kind of thing, you see a slight change in the political climate, and this abundance of corruption that we've seen, I think, will puts issue one more in play. I mean, the nursing homes, the medical industry, corporations, the state chamber, they're going to put millions upon millions into this. Trial lawyers and legal groups are going to put some millions, probably not as much. But I think the issue could come down to legislative corruption. It could be a factor. Your question?
Well, I was just going to say that may lead us to start seeing some messaging on this start sooner rather than later. There's a lot of money.
Well, that's one thing Judge Duck said.
I'm surprised we haven't already started seeing it.
No, we're going to see it soon. Mm-hmm. And I think probably the pro side is looking now at the publicity and the reaction and conversations like this and saying, we need to get started. Judge Texas, the issue for the message for those advocating issue one will be jobs and your doctor. Protect your job and protect your doctor. If we limit this liability for our employers and your doctor, then you're protecting two things precious to everybody, their doctor and their job. But now I think probably more than don't limit the damages is don't let the legislature take over the courts. On the damage cap side, just to say this, fundamentalist Christian groups, Right to Life groups, oppose the idea that you cap the value of a human life at $500,000 unless there is actual economic earnings capacity shown, which caps the life of a child or a senior citizen. And so that complicates this too. And you'll notice the governor has not yet taken
not.
A position.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's going to be most interesting.
All of that complexity, all of those political dynamics are why we cover politics, and it makes it fun. Mm-hmm.
We got into the calculus last week of the Supreme Court pick, and this has some of that calculus too. Or it's like a chess game, like if I move here, what happens here? So yeah, that's, you notice I get sort of wound up talking about this because of these competing factors.
Right, it's good stuff.
And it's very, very important.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns, including a once-a-week online-only column, can be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. You can find out about more Arkansas-related stories and interviews at TalkBusiness.com. And on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, John and Roby are back to discuss the latest with Arkansas Works. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Arkansas Republicans are, not surprisingly, approving of the selection of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to fill Anthony Kennedy's spot on the United States Supreme Court. Senator John Bozeman says Brett Kavanaugh is a distinguished jurist qualified for the position And Governor Asa Hutchinson calls the nominee highly qualified with dedication to the law. The nomination was announced last night by President Trump and will require confirmation by the U.S. Senate for him to serve on the high court. Eureka Springs will host a conference titled Destination Downtown this fall. The regional conference about revitalization will be hosted by Main Street Arkansas, Mississippi Main Street Association, and the Louisiana Main Street Program. It will take place from September 9th through the 12th. Most of the conference will be centered in the Basin Street Hotel in downtown Eureka and will include elected officials, architects, and professional planners. A conference looking at school safety is being held in North Little Rock this week. Daniel Breen, with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock, was at day one of the 14th annual Arkansas Safe Schools Conference, and he has this report.
Law enforcement and education officials from around the state gathered a week after the newly formed Arkansas School Safety Commission released its preliminary report on how to thwart and respond to threats of violence in schools. Dr. Cheryl May is chair of the commission and says she agrees with Governor Asa Hutchinson's call for more counseling services to be made available to students.
And that's one of the things we as a commission are looking at as well. So it is critically important on so many different levels. And we also looked at behavioral threat assessments. And, you know, the issue for us is this is our preliminary report. This is not our final report.
Hutchinson has directed the State Department of Education to expand the availability of school counselors. The conference's keynote speaker, school safety advocate Carly Posey, told the audience the recommended counselor-to-student ratio is 1 to 250, with a national average of about 480 students per counselor.
And I totally agree about what counselors are. Their jobs are kind of like paperwork, really. So kind of fixing that, it sounds like Governor has sort of a plan to do that here. That's great.
Posey's son survived the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting and says she supports the state school safety commission's recommendation to have armed security in schools. The commission meets again July 26th with the final report due to the governor by the end of November. Daniel Breen, KUAR News.
A blood drive to help replenish summer supplies is scheduled for tomorrow at the Job Path classroom at 203 North College in Fayetteville. The drive is scheduled to take place tomorrow from 10:30 to 3:30. Appointments can be made by calling 1-800-RED-CROSS. And the 2018 season for the Arkansas Razorback soccer team begins with exhibition matches in just under a month. The schedule was released yesterday afternoon and includes exhibition matches against Kansas State and Nebraska in early August. The K-State match will be in Fayetteville on August 4th, a Saturday. The official season begins August 17th in a tournament in State College, Pennsylvania. First home match of the official season, Friday, August 24th, against Nebraska Omaha.
With the Department of Arkansas Heritage, I'm Mark Chris of the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee. 100 years ago, on July 7th, 1918, a five-man posse approached the rural home of Tom Adkisson in Claiborne County, searching for his son, Bliss, who had not registered for the draft. A shootout followed, and a member of the posse was killed. When a larger posse returned, the Adkissons and other draft resistors opened fire, escaping into the underbrush after a 45-minute gun battle. The posse eventually swelled to more than 200 men, and on July 8th, Governor Charles Bruff sent 30 men of the Arkansas National Guard to join in the hunt for the resistors, who were members of the Russellite movement, which later became the Jehovah's Witnesses. Other Russellites were jailed, and members of the dissidents' families were interned in the Edwards Hotel in Heber Springs. All of the resistors eventually surrendered, ending the Claiborne County draft war. Tom and Bliss Adkisson were later convicted on murder charges, with Bliss getting a 20-year sentence. To learn more, visit WW1Arkansas.com.
Only about a third of Americans get enough sleep, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And that affects, among other things, how safe people are behind the wheel. Arkansas is just one of two states in the country with a law that criminalizes drowsy driving, but it's almost never enforced. Arkansas Public Media's Sarah Weitz-Kotacek takes a look at why.
Driving tired is as dangerous as driving drunk, some studies show. Pam Fisher, a New Jersey-based traffic safety consultant with the Governor's Highway Safety Association, says being tired slows us down.
The issue is really one of, you know, being sharp, being alert, being able to react quickly. So when you're tired, when you're fatigued, we know that your response times are going to be slower.
And the CDC says most people in the U.S. are tired. About two-thirds of American adults get less than the 7 hours of recommended sleep. So in 2013, Arkansas passed a law to stem drowsy driving. But there's only been one conviction a year, according to data from 2016. Mike Foster, a Highway Patrol Division commander with the Arkansas State Police, says it's hard to catch someone in the act of drowsy driving.
A sleepy person will drive and act just like someone who's impaired by drugs or alcohol. But, if they have all of a sudden a shot of adrenaline because they're being stopped by police or they're in an accident, then they don't display those signs quite as readily.
Statewide accident reports show about 900 people a year admit sleep deprivation is the reason they wrecked. Arkansas is one of just two states, along with New Jersey, that has criminalized driving tired. But to convict someone in Arkansas, a death must occur, and prosecutors must prove the driver hadn't slept for 24 hours before an accident. Fisher, the safety consultant, says if drivers in an accident don't self-disclose that they're tired, proving it is a high bar.
If states are going to take on the idea of legislating this issue, they really have to understand that there are difficulties and they have to establish parameters that truly are enforceable.
She says a jury will tend to be more lenient on a drowsy driver than a drunk driver. She says social norms need to change so that people recognize what's at stake.
And that's where I think there needs to be a cultural shift. We have to change the public's mindset about the danger of this practice.
Fisher says it's only in the last decade that safety experts have focused on drowsy driving, and there isn't really a solution yet. To her, public education is the best response. Foster, with the state police, agrees that the public underestimates the risk of drowsy driving.
People burn the candle at both ends, and there's consequences for that, and we hope they realize that and try to get some rest and not hurt anyone.
Studies show that missing more than 17 hours of sleep can produce the same blood alcohol levels as intoxication. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, Arkansas Public Media.
Support for Arkansas Public Media comes from Hot Springs Village. Those looking for a place filled with arts, culture, dining, and entertainment can find it at Hot Springs Village, where visitors can golf, boat, hike, and play all day. More information is available at explorethevillage.com. And from Simmons Bank, with more than 90 community-based locations in Arkansas providing banking and lending services. More information is available at simmonsbank.com. Simmons Bank. Dreams realized.
Tomorrow on Ozarks, the Northwest Arkansas Council is launching a new strategic plan after surveying businesses, community leaders, and others in the region. What's involved in that plan on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3. We cover the future, past, and present of where we live every day on Ozarks at Large, but understand that your everyday might not allow you to hear every one of our programs when we're on the air. That's why we have a podcast version of our show, so you can take us with you and listen to us when you have time. The Ozarks at Large podcast is free and available through all the major podcast providers like iTunes, Stitcher, and Apple TV. The Arkansas Arts Council is now accepting nominations for the 2018 Governor's Arts Awards. The annual awards recognize many different kinds of Arkansans affiliated with the arts, artists, of course, but also patrons, educators, and businesses connected to artistic work. If you can't think of someone to nominate right now, at this very moment, it's okay. Deadline is September 7th. Nomination forms are online at arkansasarts.org. There are seven different categories for nominations, from individual artist to lifetime achievement. Award recipients in recent past have included David Woolley, superintendent at Alma Schools, for his championing of arts education, and Northwest Arkansas-based Highlands Oncology Group for support of the arts. Mike Shirky, host of KUAF's The Pick and Post every Saturday night from 7 to 9, was awarded the Folklife Award in 2011. A full list of past recipients can also be found at arkansasarts.org. Robert Thomas has spent the past 12 years capturing the art of the dragonfly. He first became enamored with the insects while walking through a botanical garden in Austin, Texas. Since then, he's mastered photography of the creatures, and Saturday afternoon he'll share what he's learned and show some of his work, including photos that have been on the front of field guides at Hobbs State Park in Rogers. His free talk begins Saturday afternoon at 2, and it will be followed by a dragonfly catch and release at Hobbs Visitor Center on Highway 12, just east of the Highway 12 War Eagle Road intersection. And a new photography exhibit opens today at the Art Center of the Ozarks in downtown Springdale. Our natural state examines current Arkansans compared to its historical hardscrabble Ozark frontier people. Sponsored by the Photographic Society of Northwest Arkansas, the exhibit includes works from more than a dozen photographers, including images by Mike Disfarmer, Mayor Prince on loan from the Disfarmer Project that gained national attention earlier this decade. The exhibit at the Art Center of the Ozarks is up through August 17th, and there will be a lecture connected to the current exhibit that opens today. That lecture is scheduled for Tuesday, July 31st at 7 p.m. You can find out much more at acozarks.org.
91.3 is supported by Penguinette Barbecue, offering weekend breakfast each Saturday and Sunday, 7 to 11 a.m., at the Mission and Crossover location in Fayetteville. Menu items include breakfast taco, omelets, pancakes, and more. PenguinEds.com for information. 91.3 is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, presenting The Beyond, Georgia O'Keeffe and Contemporary Art, with more than 30 of O'Keeffe's iconic artworks, plus the work of 20 emerging artists. Developed by Crystal Bridges, this exhibition features flowers, luscious colors, city and desert scenes, feminine forms, and still lifes influenced by O'Keeffe's rich legacy. Opens on May 26th. CrystalBridges.org for more.
Pat Bianchi began playing organ when he was 7. He's the son of a working musician, and both of his grandfathers were professional musicians. So, not altogether a surprise that he's not just a professional musician himself, but a highly regarded one as well. He's twice been nominated for a Grammy, and in 2016 was named by Downbeat Magazine as the rising star in jazz. He's arriving in Northwest Arkansas this weekend as the headliner for the next installment in the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. The Pat Bianchi Trio will be at Sunrise Stage in Fayetteville Saturday night at 7:30. This month, Robert Ginsburg, host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, heard every Friday night at 10, talked with Pat Bianchi in advance of the Pat Bianchi Trio's performance here.
You grew up in the 70s and the 80s in Rochester, New York, and what, yep, to me is an environment that embraces the best of all possible worlds for a future musician. You had a musical family. You had obviously natural musical talent. You had formal training. And you had real-life training on the bandstand. Is that a fair approximation of your path into this life?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, to kind of boil it all down, you know, starting at a very young age, yes, that's probably exactly all of it.
So tell me in a little more detail about that. I mean, your family sounds very fascinating as well, with grandfathers that were performers, and your brother is a performer.
So I'll start with my grandfathers, because both grandfathers on my mother and father's side were, you know, horn players, you know, who led dance bands, I guess, for lack of better terms, around the Rochester area, you know, playing weddings, you know, a lot of, you know, different events in the 70s, 60s and 70s, when those kind of bands were still really popular. And then my grandfather, they would go back, obviously, further, where my grandfather and my dad's side was playing musicals. He was actually, before the war, he was part of a Guy Lombardo sound-alike band that would broadcast every morning on NBC. They were starting to get very famous because they, you know, a bunch of teenagers basically sounding exactly like the Guy Lombardo band. And my father actually worked as a teenager. He's a drummer. He worked in my mother's father's band. So basically, he met his future wife by playing gigs with that boss, so to speak. So that's how that all happened. For a Christmas present, I was given an old, what's called a Farfisa, which was popular with rock bands in the 60s, combo organ.
I remember them, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I was fascinated with that sound. I mean, it basically was an electronic organ.
How old were you at this time?
Yeah, I had to be 5, 6 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I would just sit and listen to these recordings for hours, and eventually I had like a toy keyboard, like one of those Magnus keyboards where it's like blows air and maybe you can play it. And I would sit down and kind of figure out little melodies. So that kind of led to a big Christmas present on my 7th birthday, the Farfisa organ from one grandfather, and the other grandfather gave me an amplifier. And that was kind of it after that. I'd sit down in the basement with learning songs, all like Glenn Miller tunes, all this by ear, hours and hours and hours. I mean, that whole period eventually led to jam sessions in the basement of my grandfather's house, where I'd go, my father would play drums, my one grandfather would play a saxophone, I would be playing keyboards, and they would just call standard after standard old tunes, you know, nonstop, keep going, you know, this kind of thing. And that eventually led to around being around 13 years old, I think I actually started performing as a sub with my father's band. I was sub for the keyboard player in there. And I know there's a picture of me floating around somewhere at that age, 13, with a tuxedo behind an old Yamaha synthesizer playing all those, you know, Glenn Miller tunes, polkas, mazurkas, you know, you name it, you know, for these, like the Elks Club kind of thing.
You got to find that. You got to find that. Yeah. That sounds like an album cover to me, man.
Or a blackmail cover, 1%.
That's great. You often hear musicians talking about the impact of working with the great band leader, and people like Art Blakey, Betty Carter, Miles Davis, they come to mind because people often refer to them as the real classroom or finishing school for a performing musician. And you've had the great fortune to work with people like Pat Martino and Lou Donaldson, and I know in the early days you had some performance experience with Red Holloway, who was one of my personal favorites. And I mean, is that truly the finishing school? Is that where it all comes together when you're working with some people like that?
I believe so, because I believe no matter what kind of music you play, write, whatever, it's real life that is where you actually learn something and learn things that stick with you. I mean, you can learn a series of rules in a classroom and how to make mathematics and mechanics but all work, but you know, when we play music, there's ultimately the thing of emotion and that emotional impact and how it affects people. And among many of the things, that can't be taught in a classroom. You know, it's like that's something that has to be learned in real life. And, you know, my first experience was finishing school, which I call it, is, you know, after I left Berkeley and I went to Denver, Colorado. There was a club out there called El Chapultepec, which was a famous jazz club at the time. And I was part of the rhythm section playing piano. And that's where I had met Red Holloway. I had worked with Dakota Staton. I had worked with Carl Fontana, Connie Condoli, Mark Elf, all these different people. So I was working with all these different masters, even if it was just for a weekend, you know, at 22 years old, just, you know, getting a taste of like, okay, this is not, you know, this isn't the classroom anymore. This is real time on the bandstand, get it together, or, you know, get off the stage kind of thing, which is really important.
Why don't you talk about really what it's like playing a Hammond B3? Because I don't think it's almost like you need to be an octopus. You've got two keyboards, you've got pedals that you're working with your feet, you've got all these stops that you're pushing and pulling. I don't know how you keep it straight, man.
It's like driving a stick shift.
Really?
That's the way I think about it. I mean, you know, do you think about when you're going to put in the clutch, like consciously think of if you've been driving a stick shift all your life, you don't think about when you're going to consciously put in the clutch and put, okay, now I'm going to go to third gear. Then wait, when it gets up to 40 miles an hour, you're going to think about it. Okay, I'll put the clutch in. Now I'm going to go up to fifth gear. But wait a minute, traffic is coming up. Maybe, I don't know, do I go to second or third? You don't think about that. You've learned that your body's learned the thing, and you just kind of do it.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm actually playing it, that's kind of headspace I'm in. It's like you can't think about it. There's too much going on.
Yeah, well, when you say it's like driving a stick shift, I get that. I kind of see that's a good analogy. But from where I sit, it looks like you're driving two stick shifts and you're in between the cars. Okay. The band you're going to be performing with includes guitarist Paul Bolenback and drummer Byron Landham. These guys were the rhythm section for Joey DeFrancesco for years. Joey, of course, perhaps one of the most famous and recognized jazz organists who ever lived, reinvented the instrument and brought it back into popularity.
Yeah.
What's it like for you kind of steering this trio in the direction of your muse? I mean, after all, I know there's a certain amount of interchange and democracy in any jazz trio, but there's a lot of momentum behind these guys.
Admittedly, you know, I'm always a touch bit nervous because no matter how you dice it up, these two cats are part of, you know, what I would consider the most influential group of musicians that I've listened to. I mean, some people have, you know, the Wes Montgomery, some people will Oscar Peterson, Ray Brown. For me, it was Joey Paul and Byron. And first being on the stage with those two cats, for me, it's, I don't want to say it's intimidating, but it makes me think twice, you know, and it's like almost kind of pinch myself. But at the same time, I mean, out of all the musicians I've worked with over the years, those two guys are probably some of the most supportive on stage and off, just people, you know, whether it be realizing musical concepts, talking about life kind of stuff, hanging out, you know, having a slice of pizza, whatever, you know, it's just as human beings, but they're wonderful people, you know, so that's, I feel so lucky on so many levels. And, you know, like I say, it affects me on so many levels. And I think one of it, you know, it's just for me, I was very fortunate because I, you know, there was also a period, probably 2007, 2008, I actually was in part of Joey's trio, playing Rhodes, keyboards, and sometimes organ with Joey. So it would be me, Joey, and Byron. We had gone across country opening up for Steely Dan. So to have the opportunity to interact with these people on the musical level, but then interact with your heroes on a personal level, I mean, it's a really special thing.
You're on tour with the trio as we speak. And what should folks in Northwest Arkansas expect when you arrive here?
I think it's going to be some new things. I think it's going to be some standards. I think some of it may be, let's see what happens when we start. But, you know, it's going to be a combination of all the above for sure. From my standpoint, and I think from the other guys too, less reading we do, the better, because less, if you're not focused on reading music, we're listening and interacting, and which is the better way to be anyways, at least from my perspective. So it's going to be a mix of stuff, I think, for sure. And I know we'll have fun. So that's, you know, be laughing a lot, giving each other a hard time on stage, you know, all in fun, of course.
Pat, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time. It's been a joy speaking with you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Pat Bianchi and his trio will perform Saturday night at 7:30 at Sunrise Stage in Fayetteville as part of the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. You can find out more at digjazz.com, the website for the North Arkansas Jazz Society. He talked with Robert Ginsberg, host of Shades of Jazz, heard every Friday night beginning at 10 on 91.3 KUAF.
With midterm elections around the corner, keeping up with the headlines this political season can seem like a chore.
Democrats need 23 seats on net to take back control of Congress.
A teacher has defeated the Kentucky State House Majority Leader in the Republican primary.
All Things Considered gives you the context and analysis and news you need without all the noise. Hear the bigger picture every afternoon.
today beginning at 3 on 91.3. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Carrollton, located along Highway 412 near Alpena. Carrollton once had about 10,000 residents. That was about 160 years ago. Carrollton, like Carroll County, is named after a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll, from Maryland. It was this week in 1826 that Charles Carroll became the last living signatory of that document, a distinction that fell upon him after both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on July 4th, 1826. Charles Carroll signed the Declaration of Independence as Charles Carroll of Carrollton to distinguish himself from other men that had the same name or similar names. Carrollton, the community, thrived in the mid-19th century, almost died about 25 years later. Then its fate was sealed just after the turn of that century when the railroad bypassed Carrollton in favor of what was called the Alpena Pass, and a depot was built in Alpena in nearby Boone County. If you stop in Carrollton now, though, you can read a marker that describes Civil War skirmishes that took place near there. We'll end today's show with music from Adam Fawcett, recorded exclusively for Ozarks at Large at the Carver Center for Public Radio. He'll be a guest of Bike Rack Brewing Company at the 8th Street Market in Bentonville Saturday night, beginning at 7. This is his song, Dust. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Enjoy what's left of your Tuesday.
But if these limbs don't shake, the air will bore me stiff and still awake. The wagon box right there at the end of my drive. It's where I found this friend of mine. God knows I won't be clean. Knock that dust off and put it on me. Pile it up and call me the king. I pray they will wait for us beyond some pearly gates. Watch for our hand to poke on through to wave goodbye as we choose to die as men again. On a track, then I'm on a track too. If you're not coming back, then I'm not coming back too. They sing, come join us, boy, you ain't no king.